podcast.
नमस्कार आणि वेलकम टू द पुणेकर पॉडकास्ट. आज आपल्या बरोबर आहेत इंद्रनील चितळे, चितळे बंधू मिठाईवाले आणि चितळे उद्योग समूहाचे यंगेस्ट आणि फोर्थ जनरेशनचे पार्टनर. आज आपण त्यांच्याशी बऱ्याच गप्पा मारणार आहोत. चला तर सुरू करूया.
नमस्कार इंद्रनील, गुड मॉर्निंग आणि वेलकम टू द पुणेकर पॉडकास्ट.
नमस्कार, थँक्यू फॉर द इन्व्हाइट अँड आय एम ग्लॅड टू बी पार्ट ऑफ द पुणेकर पॉडकास्ट. थँक्यू.
वेलकम. सो बिफोर वी स्टार्ट अ क्विक हिस्ट्री ऑफ द चितळे ग्रुप, इट्स अ व्हेरी स्टोरीड हिस्ट्री. We'd love to hear some of the key highlights of it from you.
Sure. So Chitay Group was something that was established by my great grandfather, late Shri B.G. Chitay, in the year 1939. We started off as a dairy company, and at that time it was a B2B business where with the help of the British Railway at that time, from a village called Bilodi in Sangli, Sangli district, we used to sell milk and milk products into Mumbai. As a supplier to other brands which were based out of Mumbai. This was in an era where, you know, there was no telephony or no internet or no good kind of connectivity even on the roads. So keeping a control on what exactly was happening at that time in the market was very difficult for him to analyze. So that time he got his elder son, Sri Raghunath Rao Chitay, to join him in the business. And they eventually figured out that, you know, there was no repeat customer in a city like Mumbai, which was too transitionary and the cost of operation was too high. And the kind of products that we were selling required a customer which was much more stable and repeated. So they decided to shift to Pune sometime around 44-45. And eventually that too started off as a B2B business where we were supplying milk and curd to a couple of other dairy players in the city. And they were selling that product as their own. Eventually, they realized that, you know, since the quality control mechanism at that time was not well established and there were not good systems, if tomorrow somebody used to complain that today your milk is not right, there was no way to prove it was right or wrong. But we used to get cheated very often on those claims and lose out on the money. And the brand used to profit on making money out of this. So that's when he and his younger brother, Rajabhau Chitale, both felt of the idea that, you know, we need to start selling milk under our own brand. And we need to develop our own brand, and that is how Chitay Milk as a brand was established. Since they were later joined by their younger brothers as well, and four brothers were there in the business, that's why Chitay Bandhu or Chitay Brothers as per the early registration as a company was registered. And what happened was that, you know, this was an era where pasteurization of milk was not there, pouching of milk was not there, and fresh milk, if it was not sold in the right time, it used to get contaminated.
Correct.
So in order to prevent those losses as a new brand, they felt that, you know, let us convert it into khoa, which is a form of condensed milk, and try and make mithai out of it. And that is how the Chitay Bandhu Mithai Wale as a brand came into existence. So, you know, it was more about minimizing losses from the milk business rather than profiteering anything out of it. Now, eventually, we have two parent companies in the organization. One is the dairy business where we are selling liquid milk. About 5 lakh liters of milk, liquid milk is sold every day by our company in and around Pune going up to Navi Mumbai. And our other division is basically the sweets and snacks division where we are processing sweets, Indian sweets and snacks, namkeens, savories, some bakery products, instant mixes and fruit processing products.
Amazing. So from white labeling to your own brand. So white labeling, were you probably one of the first people to ever white label?
Yes, I guess so. Because, you know, back then there were much more established players which in a very different type of a market environment. So as with any other brands that we see today, there was no other choice but to white label at the start. Because otherwise the volume viability does not come for those kind of equipments.
Understood. So tell me now, this started out obviously as a family business and almost 90 years, 80 years where
Correct.
This business has scaled up and now you're practically a national business. So
yeah.
How has this evolution happened? What were some of the challenges when you scaled up as a family business?
So I would say, I think every generation, so now I'm the fourth generation of this business and every generation that way has been instrumental in changing that trajectory of the business. So when it was my great grandfather who started with the business, he was more keen on just having viability because he started from nothing. My grandfather's generation basically were able to transition that business of supplying into a brand where, you know, Chitay Bandhu as an entity came And maybe a single store opened at Kumtekar Road, in a rented premises. And eventually, there was some stability that came into their generation. It was my father's generation who focused heavily on the idea of franchising and widening our production base and also our distribution system for retail. And in my generation, what we've been able to do is move out of our retail environment and further into a distribution chain environment where now there are almost 3 lakh stores across the country selling our product. And we are exporting as well.
This shift of more focus on distribution happened more recently, around 15 or 20 years ago.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
So our first franchisee opened in 1987. And, so we eventually went up to where we today have about close to 35 franchise stores across Maharashtra. And the distribution chain business started somewhere around 2005-2006 when, you know, seriously an investment was made into building capacity, distribution chain, supply chain, and all of those aspects to tackle to the modern trade environment that was coming up in India.
And what have been some of the advantages and benefits that you have since reaped by increasing and improving and strengthening the distribution?
See, the distribution chain business is a hardcore volume-based business. So while in the store business, we are able to do a lot of range selling and brand building properly. There is a limitation to the amount of people any store can cater and number of people it can serve. Also, the category of business that we are into, it is not something, it is more on the FMCG side. And not something that is planned purchase side. Very often we can be an impulse purchase product as well. So online and all these mediums that have came up recently are something that rival very well with the store business, but they are something that can never match the width of a distribution channel.
So the growth has been largely fueled through the distribution, and that has also further enhanced the brand awareness.
Very true. So in the current, 10-12 years, we focused heavily on increasing that, store frontage where, we were at about 12,000 stores when I was given the responsibility. Today, we have about 3,25,000 stores that are selling our product every week. So if you can see, that's about 300 times the volume itself in terms of the width of the channel that has came up. And that is reflecting in the way how our throw has also increased because, we are suddenly processing volumes also which are on the much higher side.
This actually brings me to my very next point I want to discuss is the whole automation part which you have very closely focused on over the past few years. And how did these two growth areas go hand in hand?
Yes. So the thing is, when you're selling everything in a store environment, the customer mentality is also about getting products fresh. And, as they say, just out of the oven or just out of the fryer or something like that. So there is no reference point in terms of comparison as to what you had yesterday and what you had today. And if you are able to control the variables properly, 90% of the time the product is going to taste in a similar manner. There will be that 19 bees ka farak, but beyond that, that is not something that a customer will always perceive. But when you move into a distribution chain business, everything gets packaged because you cannot package it in front of the consumer right, like you can do in your own stores. So when things get packaged, you can have at times different day products available on the same shelf.
Okay. Interesting.
And in that case, if two packets of two different days are opened, you are bound to find some sort of variation in the production, in spite of how much automation you do or how much processing you do. So, and that is the reality of the nature. So it's not just for our products, it's for every other product. So the key to retaining the consumer in that environment is that how minimized can this variation be?
And so if we were to try and understand how minimal is that variation on a sigma level, where do you think you stand right now?
Yeah, so I would say we are less than 1% now in terms of variation. So if you are to do a blind testing of, say, 3 products, say, from last year to this year, on different months of the year itself, you will not be able to make out a difference.
Fantastic. That's quite an achievement for something that's so large and varied.
Correct. But for this consistency to be achieved, there is a unfortunate part which comes with human error that you cannot eliminate. So that is where the importance and the need for automation played a very crucial role.
Okay.
And as I said, you know, our volumes have tripled. So say from 2015 to 2020, we have actually tripled our volumes in this particular line of business. So if we are to scale up those and they still retain the consistency and the quality that our consumer buys our product, that scaling up is possible only when you are able to automate the processes, because you are able to minimize the variables that are coming into the picture.
Understood. So with all of this automation now done, and I've also said that you've had a lot of new forays in the retail space with the express stores coming.
Correct, correct.
So can you tell us what is the vision and the plan around that concept?
Sure. So with automation, what happened was that firstly, the human touch on the product was reduced substantially. So we as humans, we have bacteria on our hands all the time. And this bacteria increases the load on the product, which in turn compromises the quality of the product.
Got it.
So with automation, we are able to minimize that plate count and all the microbiological factors that are needed to ensure the product preserves for a longer time.
Okay.
So that's why we are able to achieve great shelf life for these products. So once shelf life is achieved, and you know the whole issue that used to come, especially with mithai, that you know it would not last more than 3 days or 4 days. Sometimes something like rasgulla or basundi will not even last one full day because of the way the process is. We are able to bring that shelf life up to say 1 month, going up to 1 year, based on the category of the product. So with this, our reach has increased, and we are actually able to put our product in a quality controlled environment across a much wider environment. And that is where we see that the express store model is going to play a crucial role, because what we see is that there are limitations with the general trade business in spite of the scale it achieves for us, because we cannot do range selling. So with express stores, we are able to put our stores into different cities, different states, eventually different countries too in the coming year, and deliver the same quality product and the same width of the Chitoy brand has, you know, the range of the product itself, and make it available for the consumer without fighting for real estate space in a multi-brand environment like a supermarket or a kirana store would be.
Got it. And how many stores do you currently have active?
So now we have 13 express stores active at the moment in Maharashtra. We will be finishing this year off with a 14 store, hopefully by the end of this year. Next year, we plan to take that count to 30. And you know, based on how we are able to cater with the capacity increase that that is required at the back end, we will probably go up to 50 stores by the end of the next financial year.
That's 21-22?
Yes, 21-22.
That's quite fast. And these are going to be pan-India, of course.
These are going to be pan-India. So we will be crossing state boundaries very soon as well for this.
Amazing. It's really good to see a Marathi brand expand so aggressively. That is one of the key takeaways, if you ask me.
I'm glad to know.
So coming back to the business side, in the current business environment, you would have had quite a few challenges, especially last 8 months. How have you tackled these, you know, pandemic, food quality, questions around that, general purchasing power drop, just the lack of availability of options to sell? How did you handle that?
Well, so I would say there was no choice but to being reactive to a certain extent with the whole pandemic situation was, you know. But then I would say even the whole bureaucracy and the government actions on it were also reactive. So naturally, we were subjected to that reactive pushback in the first couple of weeks. Because what happened particularly was that, you know, us being an essential service player, we were allowed to run our factories. But initially, because the lockdown was so sudden, the entire ecosystem shut down without a notice. So we had to work a lot closely with most of the government agencies who cooperated very well, also realizing the need of the hour, where in drafting the policies. So how do we ensure that our packaging film supplier was up and running? How do we ensure our corrugated boxes supplier was up and running? How do we ensure our ingredient supplier was up and running? Was some factor that, you know, did not figure out into the Essential Commodities Act at first. So that is where, you know, a lot of time was spent, unfortunately, in working with the bureaucracy to try and create policies which are good for the industry to bounce back fast and fast. Unfortunately, and you know, rightfully so as well, initially the 3-4 weeks were such that, you know, there was no priority given towards anything else other than just shutting everything down and putting everybody home, because you know, nobody understood what was to be done out of it, and somehow I still feel that, you know, every everybody was hoping at that time that this will all pass like how it happened with swine flu in 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, we now know that that's definitely not happening. So with that knowledge and with now some track record of the last 8 months, how are the next 3 or 4 months shaping up?
So the critical fact was that, you know, we had to work initially a lot with the people in the ecosystem. So be it our suppliers, be it the people who work with us in the organization, be it the people who work with us further as distributors or retailers, in actually bridging that communication gap, which was probably more pyramidal before the COVID time scheme. Because, you know, naturally there was a hierarchy put into place for decisions to be more streamlined. Somewhere because of COVID, we've had to jump that gun and actually have a much more linear organization communicational pattern just to ensure that even the person at the last mile is directly communicated with the top and, you know, that transparency of communication and intent and what exactly is the direction that the organization is going to go is clear up to that last mile. So that involved us coming out of our comfort zones because, you know, we were more inclined in being decisive in our core teams, not in a very big public domain. So that meant that our outreach had to increase, our customer interaction had to increase, our key stakeholder interaction had to increase, and we had to be a lot more frequent in our exposure of what exactly was happening at the back end to bring that confidence to the consumer and all other stakeholders inside that, you know, something good is being done out of it. This is not simply for the sake of profiteering, but more from the intent of keeping things available for the consumer, especially on the milk business side. Fortunately, what has happened is that, you know, the resilience of the Indian entrepreneur is so amazing that in spite of having a lockdown policy, which was so anti-business and where we saw a lot of crisis, like even the migrant worker crisis that was there, which our suppliers had to endure through, the resilient Indian entrepreneur has found a way out of it. And I think that, you know, everybody has bounced back to close to about 85% of the pre-COVID levels in most domains of the business. So we must applaud the spirit and the attitude that us Indian entrepreneurs have. And I see that, you know, if we are this cautious in the time to come, there will be a way out of it soon because we are seeing great results from the vaccine being promoted everywhere. So in the next year, we have to be a little more patient, not cut corners on any ends. And if we are able to just hold on to our positions, which we are in right now, things will be stable or even better as we are seeing from the post-Diwali numbers at the moment.
Which was a very good period for you as well, I heard, right?
Yes, it was.
The Diwali period was especially good.
Yeah, what I would add to that is that, you know, the Diwali period was a cascading effect of all the communication activities that we as a brand did. So probably if we had not been this vocal about what exactly we were doing and being that transparent, then we would not have probably seen this kind of growth. So that way, traditionally, Indian businesses have been very reluctant in being public or, you know, being vocal about many aspects of their business because everybody prefers to be, low profile. So brands now need to take that action of, you know, not being flamboyant, but at least being vocal and communicative about what they are doing.
Fantastic. So that was insightful. I want to move on to now understanding who is Indraneel Chitale a little bit.
Yeah.
And what are your interests and what keeps you occupied after work? I know you're doing a little bit of investment in businesses. So what excites you?
Okay, sure. So I'm actually an electronics engineer and then I did my executive MBA from Harvard Business School. So that way, that engineering mindset means that, you know, I'm always up to something which probably is not, can land me into trouble sometimes. But, you know, we eventually find out a way because that is how engineering teaches you.
There's a lot of engineers in the family, am I right?
Yeah, so we have a majority of the engineers. So majority of the partners in the organization are engineers. So that way, I must say I'm lucky because, you know, that experimentative mindset is something that we are allowed to carry in the family.
So tell us a little bit about your investments that you've made and what are the areas that excite you?
Sure. So, you know, what I particularly like to focus on is that how can data be leveraged in the time to come to make decision-making more streamlined and, you know, more impactful. And that is where, you know, I've been focusing on being invested into companies that are delivering high on the data side and actually solving problems. So I have the first company that I invested was a company that is into HR analytics and HR process streamlining, and that's called HR Neeti, where you know we are basically helping organizations actually streamline the way HR as a process works in the organization. Because now, as a post pandemic, more and more people realize that you know HR and the cost of human resources itself is something that needs to be controlled very well. And this is where the analytics that we get out and also the intelligence that we are able to provide is something that is helping organizations right from automotive to manufacturing to food processing to service industries leverage benefits out of it. The other company that I am invested into is Women's Cricket Zone, which is focusing on promoting women's cricket across the world. That's more about, there is a lot of data that comes out of sport and the statistics out of it. And that paired with, you know, different types of algorithms can be great value-driven systems for a lot of allied industries. So right from brands that are trying to promote or get allied to sports, or you know the sporting goods and sporting equipment manufacturers to up to the viewership statistics are something that are highly detrimental in how sports as a medium can be used in promoting and reaching the right kind of people. So all the big data behind it is something that we are trying to utilize and see how that can create results. And so far we have been getting great outputs out of it. And the third company where I'm heavily invested and rather a co-founder is Herbie. And Herbie was formed with the idea of making Ayurveda accessible. So I have two other co-founders with me in this business. One is Dr. Chinmay Bhosle and the other is Dr. Sukumar Sardeshmukh. And Sukumar is basically a 11th generation Ayurvedic doctor. And what we have been trying to do is that, we have seen is that Ayurveda, when we speak of, is something that is thought to be highly medicinal.
Right.
And with medicine, the way human mind is, we are always very reactive with our medicine. The modern medicine as a concept itself is about reactive, that, you know, let there be something that happens and then you take an action upon it. But, you know, just like, how engineering teaches us that preventive maintenance is a lot much better than breakdown maintenance. Same is the case with medicine and Ayurveda, where Ayurveda focuses on being more of a preventive maintenance activity rather than a breakdown maintenance activity. And that is something that we want to try and bring into a packaging that is more relevant to today's times.
Interesting. So three very varied areas that you've invested into.
Correct. So Ayurveda, bringing that Indian culture to a globalized platform is what we want to try and achieve out of Herbie, and that is what we are trying to do.
Understood. You're a rider, am I right?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So tell us something about that passion.
So I think ever since I was a kid, my father too was instrumental in introducing me to reading a lot of automobile magazines as a kid. So whenever I was allowed to legally start riding motorcycles, I have been riding ever since then. I have been lucky that I have been able to ride on multiple continents on multiple types of motorcycles, tracks as well, trails, adventures, etc. Also use great motorcycles in the last 10, 15 years as well. So currently I'm riding a BMW 1200 GS bike. It is a twin bike with a boxer engine, one of the legendary designs that BMW is famous for. And I've been focusing on improving my skills on off-road riding and off-road training. So I've done two camps in the last 2 years, which is focused on different levels of difficulty in terms of riding on trails and tracks, and particularly on the off-road tracks that are there around the world. Amazing. The whole motocross activity. So I'm enjoying that nowadays.
Any chance we'll see you take part competitively some point?
I hope to. So I did try once for the annual BMW adventure competition that they organized, but I did not land up into the top three. So after that, I have realized I need to put in a lot more effort to improve my skills there. So I am hoping that in the next year, whenever things open up again, I need to put, I'll be better equipped to do that.
I think we'll be watching out for that BMW 1200 on the streets now.
Yes, yes, you can, definitely.
Coming to my last couple of questions, and this, you probably were hoping that this doesn't come up, but why is Bakarwadi such a rage across generations?
There are two things that I would say that has been instrumental in making Bakarwadi a rage. First is that, the way the recipe was formulated by my grandfather. So Bakarwadi is actually a Gujarati product. It's something that originates from Gujarat, and it's something that is not deep fried that we are used to seeing today. So in Gujarat, it used to be slightly on the sweeter side and more of a shallow fried sausage-shaped product. My grandfather was shown this recipe by a Gujarati achari that used to work with us back then. And what he tried to do was to infuse certain sort of Maharashtrian spiciness into the product and also the crispiness. So that's where the Bakarwadi, as Chitare is known for, came into existence. And it became a great hit. So firstly, we must thank our consumers that we were able to, they have supported us so much. And secondly, the process is so complicated in making Bakarwadi that initial couple of years, we were never able to supply what was the demand.
Okay.
So you might, no Punekar probably our generation has not seen this idea that Bakarwadi simply as a board or activity or a message that has been passed across societies has not come. So you might have heard that as well. And the reason it used to get finished was because it was too complicated to manufacture. And, around 70-80 people used to make just about 200-250 kg of Bakarwadi every day. So the thing with marketing is that, whatever is not available, there is a increased demand for that. And, when there is an increased demand, the popularity also increases. So that way, the family realized this and they were able to, take actions on it where they automatically the process step by step from the late 80s going up to 1994, where now we do about 1,200 kg of Bakarwadi an hour.
That's enough supply for everybody.
And that way, not anymore, because we are going to be doubling and going to up to 3,000 kg an hour soon in about 6 months' time.
Amazing. Okay.
And I think that is where, since we were able to focus on retaining all of it, that's turned out to be very well for us.
Incredible. And the whole story around Bakarwadi, Dupari, Dukan, Banda, these have spouted a lot of memes. How do you typically react to that? I know your Twitter handle is extremely on point. They don't get offended and that's fantastic. But how do you personally see a lot of these memes that are always on?
So I look at it from a very positive angle. If somebody is complaining about quality, be it the product quality or the service quality, that is something that we take it back to the drawing board and see what exactly we can improve upon. But beyond that, there are a lot of memes that associate us with the whole Puneri identity. And I feel really proud about it because people consider us to be that, close to them as a brand in their heart, where they are comfortable about making memes on us without us even asking to do that. So that just kind of shows that, the trust that people or our customers have on us as a brand and that ownership that they take in representing us as part of their culture. So it's something that we need to appreciate very well and also keep a close eye upon, because, sometimes it can be on the negative side, and if there is something that is genuine about it, we need to, as a brand, take actions on it.
Fantastic. So, Indranil, thank you so much for your time and all of this information and some fantastic insights. We really appreciate you coming on the show. Ani lavkarach tumhala bhetaychi pan ichcha aahe Bakarwadi varti. Tar thank you once again for being on the Punekar podcast.